We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, this last day of October in 2010, 2 days before the midterm elections. Today we have our guest, someone I've been wanting to get on the show for a very long time, one of the most distinguished journalists of the past 30 years in American history, a daily newspaper columnist, as well as the co-host of Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Our guest will be Juan Gonzalez for the whole hour today on Media Matters, so it should be a terrific show. But before we go to Juan Gonzalez, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Last week, NPR made the personnel decision heard round the world, or at least the cable news networks, when they fired news analyst Juan Williams after he made controversial remarks about Muslims on Fox News. It didn't take long for a handful of politicians and commentators to seize on Williams' dismissal as an opportunity to attack all federal funding for public media outlets. But Josh Silver, president of Free Press, says that what public media really needs right now is defending, not defunding.
Regardless of how you feel about whether NPR was justified in firing Juan Williams or not, the problem is calling for the full defunding of public media across the board, radio, television, community media, is absurd. It's like calling for the death penalty in small claims court.
In fact, the United States already has one of the worst funded public media systems in the world, spending only $1.43 per capita, while countries like Denmark and Finland spend upwards of $100 per person.
They call for the defunding of the system when, ironically, the need for public media funding has never been greater. We're seeing newsrooms being shuttered across the country and around the world. We're seeing newspaper staff being cut en masse as the revenue that used to go to classified ads moves to the internet. And we're seeing commercial and radio and television journalism becoming a bit of an oxymoron. You see virtually no investigative reporting of substance on radio and television.
Detractors insist that NPR and PBS programming are a waste of taxpayer dollars. But studies have shown that the public feels otherwise.
If you look at poll after poll, public media in the United States is the single most trusted brand of media. Not only that, it's one of the most trusted institutions in America, following the military as a place, a worthy place to spend public money. So the discourse you're seeing is completely out of context with how the American public really feels, and they view it as an incredibly worthy place to put public money.
Silver insists that instead of slashing funds, the opposite is needed, a dramatic reinvestment in public media.
And if we can do that, if we can create a system that is more like the successful models in other countries, we stand a chance of fostering the kind of critical journalism that this country so desperately needs.
Last week, members of the disability community in the Bay Area spoke out for net neutrality and called for the Federal Communications Commission to protect the open internet. Their letter to the FCC is a direct response to anti-net neutrality comments made in January by the World Institute on Disability. The institute told the FCC that net neutrality regulations would negatively impact people with disabilities. AT&T's public policy director chairs the World Institute's board. Ruth Ann Spinner, who helped coordinate the letter with the nonprofit organization Media Alliance, wanted to give voice to a different contingent in the disability community who believe the open internet is vital to their lives and livelihoods. Spinner, who is disabled from a spinal cord injury, uses the internet on a daily basis to help maintain her independence.
People with disabilities, like everyone else, but perhaps more so, have come to be really dependent on the internet and internet connections. I know I personally have used Craigslist for finding attendant care because it's the quickest way to post an ad for I need help X number of days and I'm paying this amount of money, call me at Y time, and then you can get lots of responses.
The open internet also allows disabled workers to work remotely or even start their own businesses. Spinner said this is especially important for a population with such a high unemployment rate, 14.8% compared to 9% for people with no disabilities.
If they are homebound by their disability, lots of people I know are conducting their business out of their home because they can do it from their computer.
To find out more information, visit media-alliance.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, the last day of October in 2010, 2 days before the midterm elections, and I'm privileged today and honored to welcome our guest, someone we've been wanting to have in the air for quite some time. He's one of the hardest working and busiest members of the journalism profession, which probably is one of the reasons we've had difficulty getting him, but we're very lucky to have him today. Our guest, Juan Gonzalez, is known to many of our listeners as the co-host of Democracy Now! He's also a columnist for the New York Daily News, an author of several books, including Harvest of Empire, and the winner of so many awards, I'd have to spend the rest of the show just going through them, but I'll just mention a couple, the George Polk Award and the 2010 Justice in Action Award. Juan Gonzalez, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Bob. It's a pleasure.
And I should let our listeners know that you are such a dedicated person that to be on our show, you're doing this from a soccer field somewhere in New York City, I take it.
Yes, my daughter is in a soccer game, and it was my turn to take her, so you may hear some cheering in the background.
Well, keep us posted if she scores.
Okay.
Oh, well, Juan Gonzalez, let's start if we can. You know, we've got elections coming up in 2 days, and obviously that's the talk of many people in the country, whatever their political views and how those elections are going to turn out. And I know from watching and listening to Democracy Now! That this is an issue that's periodically been something you've been covering. It's in the beat you've been on. What is your let's start back up. What's your assessment of the Democrats in power for 2 years? And then what's your assessment of the election?
Well, I think the key thing that probably is driving most voters is that 2 years ago they voted for change, and I think many people expected dramatic change in the way that government serviced and dealt with the needs of the general population. And I think for the most part, there's a feeling that yes, there was some change. There's definitely a in this administration dramatically from the Bush administration and of the Democrats in control of Congress from the previous Republican-controlled Congress. But it has not been the kind of substantial or qualitative change that the American people were expecting from the leadership that they elected. And I think that's showing itself in a variety of ways as people go to the polls on Tuesday. Many have already gone to the polls, obviously, with all the early voting.
You know, one of the things that was striking about the Obama administration compared, say, to the Reagan administration in the 1980s and Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration in the 1930s is that when FDR and Reagan came into office, they spent a great deal of time clarifying to the American people that the problems in the country were due to their predecessor, and they were to have to dig the country out of what they regarded as a huge hole, in the case of FDR, a depression. And it's, you know, someone compared the inaugural addresses of FDR, Reagan, and Obama. And whereas FDR and Reagan mentioned their predecessor, Herbert Hoover and Jimmy Carter, endlessly in the inauguration, Obama barely mentioned his. I mean, how much has Obama created this mess by basically taking complete responsibility for what he inherited?
Well, I think you're absolutely right in starting off with the inaugural address. Because to me, I was, as I listened to that inaugural address, and I was covering it myself in terms of the reaction in the South Bronx community, largely of African Americans, that were obviously elated over this historic event of the election of the first African American president. What I was struck by was the unwillingness of President Obama on his first day in office to lay the blame where it was in terms of how the enormous crisis that people were facing. From the very beginning, he made it clear that he was not, as FDR did, going to declare the excesses of capitalism indicted by the general public, but that he was going to seek ways to have everybody at the table in trying to rebuild the country. The result, I think, has been a pattern of conciliation to the very people who produced the mess that this country still finds itself in. I mean, just the home mortgage crisis itself, which continues to escalate. It's not as if it's gotten any better. It's actually getting worse in terms of the number of people that are being facing foreclosure every month in the United States. And I think the president, essentially telling the banks, because up until Inauguration Day, any solution that had been crafted was largely a solution of the Bush administration. But once he took office and once he agreed that the government was essentially not going to go after the banks, was going to do everything it could to keep the bankers profitable, I think that set the wrong direction and tone for governance in the 2 years since. And, of course, it's often been commented upon by many people that his choice, because, you know, the other thing about the Obama administration that has struck me is how throughout the campaign he attempted to differentiate himself from the old politics of strife and the old politics even of the Clinton administration. And yet, how many former Clinton administration officials have not been named to key positions in the Obama administration? It's almost like a second Clinton administration headed by President Obama.
Well, in foreign policy, he actually kept on the Secretary of Defense from the Bush administration.
Yes. But, I mean, to me, the amazing thing has been his the difference between his campaign rhetoric. This was going to be a real change in the way that government functions, and the reality that it's been just another version, admittedly a younger version, but still another version of the center left policies of the Clinton administration.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Juan Gonzalez, the co-host of Democracy Now!, a newspaper columnist for the New York Daily News, a storied career journalist who's written several books, including Harvest of Empire, and who has a new book coming out next year. And I'm definitely going to have you on when that book comes out, co-authored with Joe Torres from Free Press. And that's called White News. Is that right, Juan?
Well, we're still in the final days of deciding on the title, but most likely I think the final title of the book is going to be News for All. The epic story of race in the American media.
Well, that's a long overdue book.
Yes, and we have attempted to sort of look at not just the general problems. You know, everyone is critical of the media these days in terms of the kind of coverage that it provides the American people. But unfortunately, with the exception of the pioneering work that you've always been doing and a few other folks, there has not been any sort of real structural analysis of how it is that the American news media got to where it is today, and what were the internal battles within the media, what were the government policies, and what were the popular movements that affected the kind of news and information that the American people have received. And we take a look at it from the very first newspaper, from public occurrences in 1690 in Boston up until the age of the internet. And we attempt to try to sort of like figure out why is this media system so unable to provide us the kind of news we need as citizens to function in our democracy. And not what are the the misperceptions and the stereotypes, but also how did this get to be this way? What were the structural factors at work? And I think, you know, one of the interesting things I've often told people is that in a democracy, one person, one vote is a dangerous thing because obviously under one person, one vote, no elite or power group in a society can control the vote of the majority. Unless, and I think the most interesting thing that we've uncovered is that the expansion of the franchise in the United States from just property owners, white property owners, it was the early days of the Republic, especially in the Jacksonian period, was also occurred at the same time that the mass media developed. And that the development of the mass circulation papers in the 1830s was really, to some degree, not only a commercial need, but also responding to the needs of the political elite to control the thoughts and ideas of this mass of urban workers who, for the first time, were gaining the right to vote. And that really, in a capitalist democracy, the mass media played a much more important role as maintainers and defenders of those in power than they would even in an authoritarian state where the public opinion is not as necessary to control. So I think one of the things that we've uncovered is this sort of the political economics of how the mass media got to be where they are today as this really the prime vehicle today for determining public thought and public expression, more so as the television and radio have taken this preeminent role in terms of getting the advertising messages out of the politicians, the political parties and political groups have declined in their ability to able to affect public opinion. So politicians no longer worry about getting a political party endorsement. They worry about getting enough money to buy ad time on TV and radio to be able to influence the public in a new way.
Our guest today, you've just been listening to, is Juan Gonzalez. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580 coming to you live the last day in October 2010. Our phone lines are open if you'd like to call in with a question for Juan Gonzalez at 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Juan Gonzalez, the author of several books, winner of numerous awards, and probably best known to listeners around the country and viewers as the co-host with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! And also as a columnist for the New York Daily News and a longstanding daily newspaper reporter who is the past president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. And I saw you were entered into their Hall of Fame not too long ago. Congratulations about that, Juan.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And, you know, I think this issue of racism, racial and social inequality is one of the subtexts that comes into any discussion of the Tea Party movement. And even people who are proponents of the Tea Party are aware that this is sort of an issue and they attempt to diffuse it. I'd like to get your sense, Juan Gonzalez. What is your take on the Tea Party phenomenon and what role does race, well, frankly, white racism play in it?
Well, first of all, I think that the one thing we have to understand is the Tea Party phenomenon is nothing new in American history. It is only the latest manifestation of a series of right-wing populist movements that have always characterized periods of political turmoil and crisis in the United States. I mean, you have to go back to the Know-Nothing movements of the 1850s as Irish immigrants were beginning to play a key and growing role in the American political scene and then the big urban areas. You had the development of the Know-Nothings. You have had the huge Klan movements in the late 1900s, but especially in the 1920s, when millions of people joined the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan was almost a legitimate organization in many parts of the country. You've had the George Wallace movement. I remember when I was just a young college kid in 1968, and George Wallace was running for president. And he came to Madison Square Garden in New York City. George Wallace filled Madison Square Garden. More than 20,000 New Yorkers came out to hear George Wallace's ravings in New York City. And one of my earliest arrests as a protester was trying to picket outside of Madison Square Garden against George Wallace and the police picking up anybody who was even protesting. So that we had and of course, during the Clinton administration, you had the rise of the militia movements culminating in the bombing in Oklahoma City. So you had a series of right-wing populist movements that have developed throughout American history at key junctures in time and that have sought to sort of to move the country more and more in a right-wing direction. So I think the Tea Party is in this tradition. And, of course, in many of these movements, as you mentioned, there is a racist underpinning to them, because the easiest way to divide the population in America has always been between the earlier white settlers and the various groups that have come afterwards. And of course, I neglected to mention the anti-Chinese movement in the 1880s, led by Dennis Kearney and the Working Men's Party of California and others who were trying to mobilize the masses of white American workers against Chinese immigrants. So this has been it's a long tradition. It's nothing new. It's just that the young reporters these days who report on this stuff never stay awake in history to understand the relationship between what's happening now and what's happened in the past.
One thing that is different, at least in our lifetimes, Juan Gonzalez, is that now in the United States today, there is an explicitly partisan right-wing news media that it plays a very prominent role in our news culture and in sort of setting the agenda of what everyone's talking about. And I'm referring specifically to Fox News on television and then talk radio, which is dominated by hosts who are very far to the political right. And, I mean, what is the importance of this sort of right-wing media to our current political situation, in your view?
Well, I mean, it's not only Fox News, but I think the one that people don't pay much attention to is NBC, because NBC has the best of both worlds. They are sponsoring both a so-called left channel in MSNBC, and they still have their right channel in CNBC, where people who watch folks like Kudlow and others on CNBC realize that that's sort of a highbrow right-wing populism. And so NBC gets the prize, in my mind, even more than Fox, because at least Fox is consistent. But NBC gives to both parties and creates networks for both so that it can make money whichever opinion is being expressed. But I think that there's no doubt that the cable channels and talk radio have taken a much bigger role in terms of the mobilization of especially of right-wing opinion in the country, and I think that I trace the problem back to the elimination of the fairness doctrine, that the FCC promulgated decades ago and then was eventually eliminated during the Reagan era. And since then, you had the rise of not only this rabid right-wing talk radio, but also of now increasingly on television as well. And I think that there is a sense these days that that any kind of expression can be allowed on the airwaves and can be allowed by the major companies. We're not talking about there's always an independent right of anyone to present their own perspective and viewpoints, analysis of the news. But now there is no attempt even at having a clash of viewpoints so that the American people can decide. But there is an orchestrating of what kind of coverage will the people receive from show to show to show. I mean, and Fox obviously is the clearest example of in essence, a propaganda network that has developed. So we're moving now more and more into the realm of propaganda in the media than in just even pretending to provide news and information.
Our guest today, Juan Gonzalez. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. That is not a live studio audience you're hearing in the background. It is the fans following a soccer match in New York City, where Juan Gonzalez is taking time from his schedule to talk with us. And thank you so much for doing so, Juan. The telephone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open. And, you know, Juan Gonzalez, you are really in a unique position in a lot of ways as a working journalist, because you work for the New York Daily News, one of the highest circulation newspapers in the United States, if not the largest at this point. And you're also the co-host of Democracy Now!, which is probably the leading independent news media source in the United States as well. And what are, you know, you straddling these two worlds, what are the I guess the first question I'd like to ask you is, what are the sort of stories that Democracy Now! Covers that the mainstream media won't cover? What's the differences in story selection?
Well, I think the main difference is that we've always taken as our motto that we go to where the silence is. We go to the views and expressions that don't normally get heard to the grassroots organizations or local leaders who don't have access to or are not covered by the corporate or commercial media. And so we do attempt to have that as a principle, to go to where the silence is. And therefore, we are more likely to provide not just, you know, an occasional headline, but actually more in-depth coverage. For instance, just one example recently, one of our producers, Jessel Noor, went out to Chicago to actually interview and put on the voices of the parents in a Chicago school that had occupied their school for more than a month because the Chicago public school system wanted to close down a building. And they were complaining that their school did not even have a library and that the Chicago public school system had misappropriated and misused the funds that were supposed to rebuild, renovate their school to demolish one of the buildings that they were using. So they held out in an occupation for more than a month. I refer to them sort of as the educational equivalent of a Republic Windows and Doors,
mm-hmm.
Because they were, again, immigrant Mexican women who took over that building and held it and eventually forced the Chicago public school system to back down. Much as the workers from Republic Windows and Doors occupy their own factory. So this is a story that we actually had a member of our staff go out there, do a report, and provide not just the headlines, but the actual voices of the children and the women that were in the occupation. So those are the kinds of stories, I think, that we do that you'll rarely find in the corporate and commercial media. And the other big thing is obviously international news.
Mm-hmm.
As international news has almost disappeared from the major national news broadcasts, except when there is a war, a U.S. Involved war, or unless the White House wants to put attention, say, on the Iran negotiations over nuclear energy. But other than that, most of the rest of the world is ignored, and we have a lot more international coverage than you would find in almost any other news, regular news program that is airing in the United States today. So I think in those two areas, in the emphasis on international news in places that are not the hot spots necessarily, as also in terms of going to where the silence is, to the voices that are not being heard, that separates Democracy Now. And I think the other thing is, whoever comes on our show, whatever their opinion is, they get to talk in full sentences and paragraphs. We don't reduce them to four or five words or a phrase or a soundbite, and we give them the opportunity to fully express their ideas and their viewpoints. And I think the listeners and viewers appreciate actually listening to human beings work out their thoughts and give their opinions in a fuller sense.
Have you and Amy ever been approached by one of the corporate media commercial cable networks about possibly having a program on one of their channels?
No, we haven't. And to tell you the truth, I would be leery if we were, because you know, I'm from the old school, you know, with in terms of believing that you can be killed by sugar-coated bullets as well as real bullets. And I think that the reality is we have tried to build a grassroots network. We have cobbled together through the various community efforts in community radio and college stations and public access, we have in essence tried to cobble together an independent network, and through the internet that is really has spread dramatically. Whereas many major media companies are in decline, Democracy Now! Continues to grow in terms of the number of stations and outlets and budget and staff, so that we have been able to grow in an otherwise dismal media landscape. Now, I know people will say, well, Juan, you're still working in the commercial media, you're still working at the New York Daily News, where the audience is completely different. But I have always maintained that progressives and who see themselves as having a role in the media have to understand that the American people receive their news in various ways, and that we have a responsibility not only to create alternative and independent media, but we have a responsibility to organize our fellow journalists within the commercial media and to open space within the commercial media for other viewpoints, not cede the entire corporate media and the entire commercial media to the forces of a reaction. So that I think that what's needed is always a dual strategy, both the promotion of independent alternative voices as well as a continuing battle, and especially the organization of the American journalists, because I believe that 80 to 90% of all journalists in America want to produce relevant and important news. However, they feel afraid. They follow what their bosses tell them. They're fearful of not getting promoted, of losing their jobs. They're not organized. Unions have declined as the unions within the media industry have declined in influence and force. And so they stay quiet, and many of them hate their jobs or hate what their jobs have become, but because they see no other alternative, they don't see a chance to fight. So that's why I've sort of maintained it as my perspective that you've got to fight in both worlds, both the independent alternative news as well as in the established commercial and corporate press. And as you know, there are very many fine journalists within the commercial media who have produced important, sometimes seminal reports, but they're few and far between, more needed, and somebody's got to show the journalists who are in those in the commercial media that it is possible to fight and keep your job.
Our guest today,
so that's what I've tried to do.
Our guest, Juan Gonzalez, you've just been listening to. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Thank you for joining us. This is a live show, so we're accepting phone calls. We can call in at 333-9455 or go to 1-800-222-9455. Juan Gonzalez, the award-winning journalist with both the New York Daily News and the co-host of Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and the author of several books. And we'll have him back when the new book comes out. We've already talked about it earlier today. Juan Gonzalez, one of the really interesting stories that Democracy Now! Recently covered, and I think it's in many ways it's interesting at first in the absolute importance of the story itself for this country's politics, but also in the way it's been covered by the mainstream media in this country and compared to other countries, is the entire WikiLeaks story and how WikiLeaks, the documents it's released concerning U.S. and allied conduct in Iraq. And I know this has been a story that you guys have been covering at Democracy Now! Well, what's your assessment on how the rest of the news media have covered this story, maybe compared to the Pentagon Papers and compared to how Britain and other countries in the world are covering it?
Well, I think one of the things is that we had already established a relationship with WikiLeaks prior to this latest release, so that they felt more comfortable with us in terms of getting out some of this information, so that, for instance, we were able last week on a Friday to have Daniel Ellsberg come on as he was heading out to London to meet with the folks from WikiLeaks to release at the official release of the latest batch of documents. And so Ellsberg really sort of gave a preview of what was about to happen. And I was just talking with Amy this past Friday, because it happened a week ago, and we had our biggest explosion of internet traffic during the Daniel Ellsberg Daniel Ellsberg interview. I mean, normally we might get about 100,000 or so hits on a particular show. The Ellsberg segment went over 700,000.
Wow.
That went to the website to pull down that interview. So it was obviously, it was a huge story. And the amazing thing is that for the most part, with a few exceptions, the corporate media treated this, I would say, the similar manner to they did with the Gary Webb Dark Alliance series about a decade or more back.
Mm-hmm.
They basically said, there's nothing new here. You know, this is all generally known. There's more details. When it is really an exhaustive look at what has happened with the Iraq War, and provides a whole realm of new information in terms of the numbers of casualties, in terms of the role of the United States and Iraqi forces in torture, and this is all documented from U.S. from the very records of the United States government, which means the military was well aware, and the administration was well aware of what was going on and to what degree the casualties were being underreported. And so I think it was an enormous story. But the media took, the corporate media for the most part, because it could not be stopped, then took the position, well, this is largely rehashed material, nothing new here.
We've got Juan Gonzalez with us, talking to us from New York City, the co-host of Democracy Now! And columnist for the New York Daily News. Our phone lines are open at 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Juan Gonzalez.
Yes, hello. I wanted to talk about the invocation of God language into news. It seems like as soon as we hit that and it became acceptable in mainstream news programming and writing, that that was a slippery slope that we're not going to come back from anytime soon. And I'm not talking just about, I mean, there's obvious Glenn Beck, who's obviously invoked God language. So what do you say? He starts talking about God. Everybody comes to a grinding stop, you know. Even Chris Matthews, you know, when he talks about Glenn Beck talking about God, okay, well, I know he's Catholic, and I don't know why I know that. If he's, you know, presenting an unbalanced presentation of the news, but what hasn't happened, I think, in the media, is that okay, they're invoking, you know, they're talking about liberation theology and stuff. Well, as a graduate of seminary, I can tell you that there is a very determined group of people, huge group of people at the grassroots, who are opposed to things like liberation theology, whether they understand it or not. And Glenn Beck is the product of them, as are a lot of these Tea Party candidates.
Well, thank you very much, caller, for your comment. Juan Gonzalez, separation of church and state, resurgence of God, what's your take?
Well, again, I would say, as I said with the Tea Party movement, I don't believe that this is anything dramatically new that has occurred in recent years. Our nation has had a continuing battle over the relationship of church and state, and there have been religious revival movements throughout American history that have attempted sort of influence or control our political direction, that generally speaking, those who understand that that because of the multi-religious and multi-ethnic and racial history of the United States, any attempt by one religious group or another to impose their conception of religion on the United States. I mean, because obviously the whole battle over the now directed against Muslims throughout, as the mosque near Ground Zero and the other mosques around the country show that any attempt to try to impose a perspective in terms of what God wants for America will inevitably create conflict among the American people. And so I think that the framers of the Constitution were perfectly right to keep separation of church and state, and I think it's but that doesn't mean that it's a settled question among the American people or among various religious groups in the country.
Juan Gonzalez, you have written in your columns and done news reports and really throughout your career been an activist concerning Puerto Rican rights. And I'm wondering if what you think most Americans, what they ought to know about Puerto Rico that they don't know. I mean, what's going on? What's the story of Puerto Rico that's been missing in not just in mainstream debate, but among even progressives about what's happening in that country? That if you had an opportunity to let people know, you would tell them.
Well, as anyone who listens to or watches Democracy Now! Knows, we probably produce more reporting on what's going on in Puerto Rico than any other news program. I have always pressed for that among the producers in the show because I've always been convinced that the mere existence of Puerto Rico as a territory of the United States is one of the, as a colony of the United States, is one of the great unresolved injustices in American history. The United States has claimed Puerto Rico as a territory for 112 years, since 1898. And despite the fact that regularly over the last 50 years or so, the United Nations has repeatedly passed resolutions, the United Nations General Assembly, saying that Puerto Rico is a nation with a right to self-determination. Puerto Rico has been the most valuable territory, produced more profits for American corporations than virtually any other nation in the world. In terms of the sheer profit levels that American companies have taken out of Puerto Rico, compared to even major countries like Britain or France or Italy, or it's been a huge, huge profit center for American corporations, largely for the pharmaceutical industry, which is the main industry that utilizes Puerto Rican workers in the production of virtually, an endless stream of pills that Americans consume. Most of them are manufactured in Puerto Rico. So that the island is a hugely important economically. It is a colony of the United States, and yet the United States government, Congress, has done nothing to try to resolve this situation of what will be the final status of Puerto Rico. Will it become a state? Well, the problem is that, see, there's always been a political battle over the admission of any state to the Union. Because the admission of every state to the Union creates new elected Congress members, new elected senators, and has the potential to shift political balance of powers in Congress. In the case of Puerto Rico, if Puerto Rico were to become a state, you'd have two U.S. senators and six or seven congressmen that would then be in the Congress. But the problem is that unlike any other territory that the United States claimed and continued to hold on to, most of the territories that became states had a majority white population, white American population, by the time they became a state. And that's why New Mexico and Arizona took a little longer, and Hawaii and Alaska, they had to wait till they had at least a, if not a majority, then a plurality of whites living in the territories.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Puerto Rico, after 112 years of being under U.S. rule, the percentage of white Americans living in Puerto Rico is barely 5%. 95% of the population remains Puerto Rican, but then there's a growing Dominican population. So there has been no change in the demographic character of the island, and yet it is not, it's a small island, but it's not small in population. There are 4 million people living in Puerto Rico. That's greater than the population of 24 states, you know, much greater than places like Wyoming or Utah or any of these other much larger states.
No, that's almost the population, say, of Wisconsin.
Speaking a different language, and yet Congress cannot admit it as a state. They refuse to grant it independence, and the current Commonwealth status is noticeable. It's continuing to hemorrhage economically, but no one wants to resolve the question, what do you do with Puerto Rico? And as long as Congress doesn't have any violent movement for independence creating problems, it continues to ignore the issue. So I think that it's one of the really unresolved questions of American democracy. What do you do with the biggest colony that the United States holds, which is Puerto Rico?
Were there to be a plebiscite in Puerto Rico and the options being independence, statehood, or maintain the status quo?
There's been another formulation that many people have pressed, which the United Nations recognizes, which is called free association.
Mm-hmm.
And under free association, the United Nations recognizes three ways for colonies to be decolonized. One is annexation or incorporation by statehood, incorporation into the existing state on an equal basis with all other citizens. Or two is independence, and three is free association. Free association means that the colonizer nation recognizes the colonial nation as a sovereign state, but that the two enter into a free association of equals, whereby for instance, that Puerto Rico could have its own representation in the United Nations, could have its own economic treaties, but that it might agree to do joint defense with the United States, might agree to have a joint money system, might agree to have joint citizenships. That is a recognized alternative from the United Nations. But the current autonomy status, which is a Commonwealth status, does not recognize the sovereignty of Puerto Rico. It does not provide for Puerto Rico to have its own ability to do international economic treaties or to be represented in the United Nations. It doesn't recognize that Puerto Rico is a separate nation, distinct from the United States, that is being held and has been held in colonial bondage for 112 years.
Our guest today in Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Juan Gonzalez, the New York Daily News columnist and the co-host of Democracy Now! We've only got about 10 minutes left in the show. He's been joining us from a soccer field in New York City where he's watching his daughter play soccer while talking to us, and we can't thank him enough for taking time from his incredibly busy schedule to join us. Juan Gonzalez, you began your activist's career back in the 1960s, a few years before I came of age, but you know, you've been politically involved in this country's history now for probably 45 years, say. And, you know, I'm wondering, as you look back, cutting your teeth in what was probably the most politicized year of American history since the 1930s, what your sense is of the arc of American history from, you know, when you were 18, 19, 20, to where it is today, and where, as you look at your daughter's future, it might be 30, 40 years from now? I know it's a big question, but, you know, it's something you can't help but reflect upon, I would imagine.
Well, you know, I had a discussion on this topic when we were speaking to the new millennium and on Democracy Now! With Amy, and we were talking about what were the main changes that people would look back on the 20th century in terms of how the nation and the country changed. And I firmly believe, or I've come to believe after many, many years of thinking about this stuff, is that that the main event that occurred in the 20th century was that the Third World stood up, that the colonial peoples of Asia, Africa, and Latin America won their own place on the world stage, asserted their own nationality and their own independence, separate apart from the colonial powers of Europe and the United States. This was largely a result of basically the two world wars, especially of World War II, that the colonial powers they could no longer justify, after defeating Nazi Germany, holding on to the colonies of India and Algeria and all the French colonies and the English colonies and the American colonies. The Americans finally gave up the Philippines, but they have held on to Puerto Rico. And so the Third World stood up. And after World War II, what started happening was that the Third World started going to the West, that you had this enormous increase in mass migrations, where the peoples of the former colonial powers started coming to the metropolis. And so today, France doesn't know what to do about all the Algerians and the Tunisians and the Moroccans. England doesn't know what to do about all the Indians and the Pakistanis and the Jamaicans. And the United States doesn't know what to do about all the Latin Americans and the Caribbean peoples that have come to its shores. Every one of these countries has been inundated by immigration from its former colonies. As a result, the countries of the metropolis are being transformed. The working class of these advanced countries is being transformed. And many of the divisions that we see now are a result of the sense of insecurity and fear of this change that is occurring, when the reality is that it was all created by capitalism. Capitalism wanted to tear down the borders of nations for the free movement of money and capital, not expecting that by tearing down those boundaries, there would also be the free movement of labor. And it's the other side of globalization is the mass migration, the internationalization of labor, especially the movement from the Third World to the West. And I think that was the great movement of the 20th century, that the 21st century will have to figure out how to deal with it. And, of course, the rise of China and India and Brazil and Mexico as economic powers are all part of that, are all part of the result of the Third World standing up that began really in the mid part of the 20th century.
Our guest, Juan Gonzalez, you've just been listening to. We have a couple of callers who have been waiting patiently. Let's get to them now as we close out the hour. Let's start with line one. Urbana, you're on the air with Juan Gonzalez.
Yes. I just wanted to say I have worked with people from all over the world in our country for many years, and I think they make wonderful American citizens. The vast majority are just like Americans in their values, and, of course, there are some bad apples in every culture. But I wanted to maybe transition back a little bit to the news media.
Okay.
In the United States. I've been concerned because, first of all, is there any way to find out who owns the news stations on television and radio and their politics? Because it seems to me that during the early years of the Bush administration, the radio stations and television stations were bought out from under the American citizen's nose before we knew what was happening. It was not publicized, and the next thing we knew, like our local radio station, WDWS is totally right-wing. All of their programs are right-wing, despite they're supposed to be serving the whole community, many of the television stations. And I have a question. I understand that Rush Limbaugh, when he began, he gave his program to radio stations free as long as they would use, I believe it's 4 hours. If that is true, that seems, you know, to be something that started a very vicious cycle in our talk radio. I can hardly find any that are even moderate or fair most of the things in traveling up and down the state or around the country, when you turn on talk radio, it's by and large right wing. Also, yeah. Television.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Juan Gonzalez, any comments?
Yeah, well, in terms of being able to track the ownership, the Columbia Journalism Review has for years had a running tabulation. If you're interested, you can go to their website. It's called Who Owns the Media, and they keep up-to-date track on the changes, because many of these media companies go through so many changes of hands of ownership, and so that's possible to track. Unfortunately, one of the things that's happening increasingly with the media, as is happening with much of corporate America, is that even corporations no longer are the real powers behind a lot of these companies, because the corporations themselves sometimes are largely controlled by hedge funds, by private equity firms, for whose ownership and whose real control is a lot more difficult to get your hands on than even, because at least corporations have to file with the SEC regular filings, and they have to have elections of the shareholders, and they have to have minutes of board of directors meetings and so forth. But the private equity funds that are increasingly beginning to dominate American capitalism have to go through a lot of those same kinds of public disclosure, so it becomes even harder to trace the media. But I agree with you that there has been increasingly those who own and control the media, especially the major commercial media, have been increasingly right-wing in their outlooks. And it's been my experience working in commercial media for many years is that often the owner doesn't even have to tell the lower-level people who run these news organizations what to do. They just know what the owner's feelings and viewpoints are, and they seek to curry favor by turning their news organizations into mouthpieces for what they believe the owner wants, because that's their way to be promoted up the ranks of the corporate ladder. But yes, there's increasingly much more control, I think, by right-wing, openly right-wing capital now of our media companies, precisely for what I said earlier, that it's very important in a democracy to be able to use the media to control how the public sees the events that are happening.
Let's go to our final caller now. We've only got a couple minutes left. If that line two, Urbana, we're sorry for the late recognition of your call, but please take it over.
Thank you. I'll try to be quick. Two companies I used to work for moved their headquarters to Puerto Rico a few years ago, and I'm assuming there must be some advantages to for businesses to move there. And I was wondering if you could talk about that. How would statehood for Puerto Rico affect American businesses? Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller. Juan, can you give us your concise version?
Well, under either statehood or independence, the benefits of the current colonial status would be ended, because the basic thing is that right now firms that locate in Puerto Rico who spend a lot of money on research and development have huge incentives, because they can transfer all the intellectual property that they developed here in the United States, the patents, to Puerto Rico, and then shelter all of their income from U.S. taxes.
On that note, Juan Gonzalez, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate you taking an hour, and I hope your daughter scored, and I hope her team won.
Okay, I think the second half is starting, so we should
all right.
Not decided yet.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you very much, Juan Gonzalez. I want to thank Kyle Croha, too, my engineer today, Melissa Trentz, the producer, for her great work. I'm Bob McChesney. Be back in 167 hours. Everyone vote on Tuesday and be back here on Sunday.